Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
We're at chapter 6, but I promised you I would go back to the end of chapter 5 and talk about Gehazi. The Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about Gehazi. It's painful to us because he was one of our own, so to speak. Like, he was somebody on the team. He was Elisha's second-hand man, and he made a terrible mistake. It's very interesting. In the Torah, you find that there's one sin that Hashem really gets upset with, and that's what's known as Chilul Hashem, like profaning His name. Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the giver of the Torah and probably the greatest person, because he hit the rock, Hashem said, well, you know, people saw you get angry and you didn't make as big of a Kiddush Hashem. See, people, if they had seen that, if you had spoken to the rock and the water had come forth, they would have grown stronger in their belief. But now that you hit the rock, they're going to think there's some hocus pocus there, there's maybe under the rock there was the water supply, but you made... it's not even that he made a Chilul Hashem, he made less of a Kiddush Hashem. The other person we find were the sons of Eli. If you remember, when the people would come up with their offerings, they would help themselves to the best pieces. And they were kind of slow on the offerings that didn't have much meat. Some of the offerings are birds, and you know, on a little dove, there's very little stake in that. And so they kind of left those offerings later, and they did the big, you know, powerful bulls, so they would have a good barbecue. And they gave people a bad taste for religion, and that's a Chilul Hashem. Over here, Gehazi gives here was the opportunity to do outreach to the Gentile world. And I mentioned to you, sometimes we need to see it in the eyes of the Gentiles, how they see it, and then we ourselves come to a strong sense of belief. And so, if we had seen that this general of Aram, how his leprosy had been cured, and how we had talked about it, who knows what the reaction. But because money was taken, and money was exchanged, and he went to... So the effect was less. He never... It doesn't say whether he found out that it was Elisha didn't do it, but once you mix money and religion, people don't look at it the same. You know, they view it as somehow the person is compromised. You know, so Elisha, yeah, he did a miracle, but he got paid for it, so that's why he did the miracle. Or he only does miracles like that for rich people that can pay him lots of money, but the poor people, they can... Oh, welcome back. Good to see you. They're not going to get the same kind of miracle. And so Gehazi really took that miracle away, so to speak. Here was the opportunity. Here was the big Kiddush Hashem that the Tzaras would be cured and would be a message to the nation and to the tent, and he blew it. So he gets a very stern punishment. He gets leprosy, and his children, apparently, who were in it with him, they also get leprosy. Our tradition has it that after this he did other things that were bad as well. Although we're going to hear about him maybe once more in Tanakh. We mentioned that the Isha HaShunamis didn't want to deal with Gehazi. We mentioned that. And we said she was very astute. She saw something, even though a prophet is called the seer, and Hashem speaks to her, she saw something that Elisha didn't see. And she didn't want to deal with him, if you remember, because she just felt she had a sense that this, you know, Gehazi was no good. Which was amazing, because at this point Elisha didn't see it. That was the other thing we mentioned, the Medrash, that when he went to revive the child that had died, he lacked a certain belief, or he wanted to test. We said the Medrash said he wanted to test the stick on the dead dog on the way there, or that he kind of didn't have full faith in his master. And Elisha just sometimes very great people aren't aware that those around them aren't so great. You know, maybe whatever, on some level he didn't see that. It says over here, though, that the Gemara says a very interesting thing, that sometimes you need to push someone away. Gehazi was he was in charge of the academy, and he was a great person, and he was too money hungry, so he needed to be pushed away. It says La'olam yehei smol docha, that you should push away with the left hand and bring near with the right hand. And meaning that it's true that sometimes you need to be harsh with people, but as every time you make a statement of harshness, you need to make sure that you have an even stronger statement of bringing near. The right hand is always stronger than the left hand. And they say that Elisha didn't push Gehazi too far. In other words, because some people say it's because he said La'olam, forever. In other words, when he gave him the leprosy, he didn't say, alright, you got leprosy. He says, verse 27, the last verse, he says, Etzaras nantiv avazar la'olam. That's it. You're finished. That's it. You're the rest of your life, the rest of the world, forever is a long time. He said, that's it. You're leprous forever. Nothing, you know. That was a little strong. You know, he didn't, if he had left the door open a little bit, then maybe Gehazi would have come back. And so they, the rabbis are funny because you never know when they're going to judge some, but they felt that Elisha was a little bit too strict with Gehazi. If he had, see, maybe he hadn't used that word forever, maybe Gehazi would have, he or his children would have come back, wouldn't have been so bad. But once Gehazi was out of the camp, so to speak, he went and he did terrible things. That's their tradition as to what happened with Gehazi. Now, very interesting. There's a few ways to read what's going to happen here. Let's read the next verse. First verse in chapter 6. V'yomer b'nei ha'neviim el Elisha. And the sons of the prophet said to Elisha. Interesting, they're called the sons. Sometimes it's because they're like, the prophet was called father. I think I mentioned to you, the Christians stole that from us. We used to call our religious leaders father. You know, like that was they got it from the Tanakh. Now we don't use it because it doesn't have the same, you know, father. You know, we use rabbi, teacher. But the Bnei Nevi'im were like the children of the Nevi'im, the sons of the prophets. So they said, Hinei ha'makom asher anachnu yoshevim shel nasar mimenu. Things are kind of tight. There's not enough. It's crowded. So why was it crowded? What was the story here? So you could learn this a lot of different ways. It could be that Gehazi was a very good administrator. That's why he needed the money so much, was that as long as he was around, there was plenty of room, there was plenty of space. He somehow worked it. Now, the second that he's gone, all of a sudden everybody's complaining. There's not enough space. Things are crowded. There's a tradition that Gehazi kept people away. That he was, he turned people off. And once he was gone, all of a sudden the place was full and there was not enough room. And so right away, once he's out of the picture, all of a sudden it mentions that there wasn't enough room. One of the rules, there's a debate throughout the Talmud about whether or not a teacher should accept disciples whose insides aren't the same as their outsides. Meaning that in the ideal world, when you select people to transmit the leadership and the Torah of the next generation, you want people that are sincere and that you can trust and that have the right qualities. And the expression usually is their insides match their outside. They're not hiding anything. They're not hypocritical. And some people are very selective about who they would accept in their circle, who their disciples would be. Other people felt that somebody wants to come study, let them study, and maybe their insides will change. Maybe you should just open the doors. And what happened with Gehazi was that on the outside he appeared to be good and holy and pious, and on the inside he was rotten. And his punishment was that the leprosy broke out so that everybody could see, you know, stay away from him. Sometimes there are people you want to stay away from, you don't know until because it's on the inside. And then it kind of, so his leprosy broke out, but he kept people away. And now that he was gone, it was crowded. people came. But you find this debate, and it has not been resolved per se. There are different approaches to do you be selective? Do you try to only have people that are all on the same, you know, same page or sincere, or do you open up one thing that a lot of people aren't aware of, and that was in Poland, in Russia, when the in the yeshivas, a lot of the non-Jewish schools weren't open to Jews. The universities weren't open to Jews in Poland and in the Ukraine, and or they only accepted like a very small amount of Jews were allowed in the university. And so if somebody wanted to study, they went to the yeshivas. So the revolutionaries also studied, the communist, the socialist revolutionaries also studied in the yeshivas, because they had nowhere else to there was nowhere else to go. That was, if you wanted to develop your mind, that's where you went. And so the yeshivas in Europe in the turn of the century became breeding grounds for a lot of the socialists and the anarchists, and they that studied and it became its big challenge, because sometimes they won over the yeshiva students to that point of view. That was just that's just more of a historical point that people weren't aware of. But it was just imagine you went to Hebrew school with Trotsky, you know, or something like that, or with somebody that was but that's what happened, because that was the only outlet for the Jewish intellectuals, and so there was a lot of and a lot of the socialists and the anarchists and the different leaders of the different movements had studied in yeshivas when they were younger, because that was where you developed your thinking. But there was a debate about, do we open our doors to everyone, or do we only be selective and say, well, we don't want people that just want to develop their mind. We want people that are believe in Hashem and want to become better people, or how accepting do you want to be? That's always been the question. And different leaders have had different styles. It's interesting, in Israel, they have this one yeshiva called the Mir Yeshiva. It's the world's largest yeshiva. And the head of it recently passed away. They have 6,000 students. And they're not so selective, meaning they take pretty much, you know, pretty much anybody. I don't want to say anybody. I don't know. You know, I'm sure everybody has some. And they just have been, you know, booming in size, and, you know, doubling and tripling, and it's everybody knows you can go to Israel and you could just put yourself down in the Mir. No other place works out. You can go to the Mir. That guy's called the truck stop. You know, it's like a big, huge yeshiva, wonderful yeshiva. And then there are other yeshivas where there's waiting lists, and it takes years to get into, and you have to really, really push, and you know, it's just they're different styles. And so it's just interesting that debate about, do you be selective? But apparently Gehazi was very selective. He didn't let everybody have access. Once he was gone, everybody had access, but it was too crowded. So now what? You know, now what do you do? Yes. Mm-hmm.
The people in Mir, is it a good quality?
Oh yeah. Top yeshiva, one of the, you know, top in the world. But their style has been there that they if somebody wants to study there, they're open to it. They're not likely to say, well, you've got to pass our test. This is the Ivy League of the yeshivas. We don't accept everybody. That's not how they talk. They they're more accepting. So Elisha Gehazi, though, did have that view, and he's gone, and now all of a sudden it's too crowded. So let's see what happens. Verse 2, Nelchana, so we need a building campaign. But in those days, you didn't build it with money. You went outside, and you knocked down some trees, and you did some work. So let's go, Nechada Yardin. And so they decided to make a location for a new building, and they decided they wanted to build it right near the river. We'll take some beams. Let's get the new place. And they said, we like that idea. Let's go set up a new school over there. Why would they want to go there? What was special about the Yarden? So one view is that Eliyahu, if you remember, went up to heaven by the Yarden, by the Jordan. So perhaps that was the reason why they wanted to be like to the spot where Elijah went up to heaven. That sounds like a good place to have a, you know, you pick a place for your school. we do find that there's an idea of water, that of life-giving water, that water is very special. One of the holiest times of year is on Sukkot, where we have the ceremony of the water drawing, the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. The Rambam says that if you look out on the water, you can see Hashem. If you look out at the ocean and you see Nibor, there's a certain they say when you look out into the vastness of the oceans and the waters, a person feels something in their heart. They feel, some people, you feel the divine. There's a, it's a hard thing to say, because you say, what is God? Where is God? But it's just like when you pray and you daven at certain times and certain places, many people experience this when they see the vastness of the water. All of a sudden they feel their creator. Because when you look at Bereishis, it's the waters, and the, so there is something to that, and something to see, the big bodies of water, or the, so they said, you know what, let's build a study hall over there. That's a good spot. So they liked that idea. So now they need volunteers. So v'yom echad hoyel na v'lei chalav dech v'omai, who wants to go? I'll go. Verse 4, v'yedek yitam v'yovah, they went to Yarden v'yigreitim, they started cutting down the wood. Verse 5, v'yeh echad mapel korah, and one guy's chopping down the trees, and they must have been very close to the water. That's the barzel nafel amayim, and the blade on the axe flew off. Now, in Chumash, apparently their axes didn't hold on so well, because it talked about accidents, you know, with somebody swinging and the axe flies off the... I wonder if that's just... I guess you have the blade and you have the wood. We have, like, iron or something that we mulch. You know, we have these drills that we hold the wood to the axe. They didn't have that, so...
No,
you know.
That's still a problem.
Oh, is it a problem, sir?
Yes, the blade tends to loosen as you use it.
So they still haven't solved that problem. I was hoping they had, after all these thousands of years.
I see. Whether it's going to go flying.
I see. So you really got to be careful when you're who's around you, or make sure the coast is empty.
Why can't they make the handle metal as well?
It'd be too heavy, I think. The wood is lighter, so that you get a... So they're chopping away, and the handle flies off, and it goes into the river. Now, verse 5. Now, this gives you an idea of the poverty. Either they were very poor, because they couldn't afford their own axes, or, but let's see what he says. Verse 5. And the blade, the hatchet fell, the top part fell into the water. And he cries, oh my goodness. Aha! We had that word tanah. Aha! I was like, whoa, this is not good. Hashem, this is borrowed. And part of it is that a person, when they borrow something, a person has to feel an obligation. I hate to say it, but we don't do a good job with the idea that when you borrow something, you have to give it back. And because people borrow things, and really good, sincere, sweet people, and there are people who just forget to give it back, who don't give it back right away, it's just part of life. It's just a certain, I don't know how you teach that. Everybody should have a course in life. When you borrow something, even though they gave it to you and they were happy to give it to you, you got to get it back. And sometimes you get things back after years. You forget who you loaned it to. And somebody said, oh, I had it, you know, well, why didn't you give it back? Right? So, but that's part, you borrow something, when you're done, you give it back. The Talmud says a person, when you borrow something, you have liability. You're responsible. So they borrowed this hatchet, and then he lost it. To him, this was terrible. I borrowed this. I have to get that back. He says, aha, Shem, who show it? Borrowed. Everybody has their axe too. In other words, everybody has their axe to grind. I don't know where that expression comes from, but everybody has the kind that they like, you know, that they cut the handle perfect to size and it fits them well. And you can't, especially in those days, you couldn't just go to Home Depot and get the same axe. You had to, this was a personal axe, and if somebody loaned that to you, you should get it back, the same one that he loaned to you. So he asked, V'yomer Ish Elohim, so the man of God, So first of all, you see, Elisha was helping with the building. He was there. You know, he wasn't separate from them. He didn't say, well, you know, I'm the teacher, you guys. But he was there. He was part of the group. So he said, show me where it fell. Not enough of a Yireyu. They showed him where it fell. It's a makum. But he cut to the eight, and he cut a piece of wood, the Yashlech Shama, and he threw the piece of wood there, the Yatsiv Abarzel, and the metal floated up. Now, the metal is heavy. That never floats. Wood is what floats. So what happens here is that wood that usually floats sinks down, and the metal that's heavy comes up. And there is a symbolism. In a certain way, this is what happened with Gehazi. Gehazi was the disciple that was very pious and was studying the teachings, and he sunk down, and then now they opened the doors, and the outside people came in. But this is an idea that there's a miracle, that Hashem is the one that's in charge of nature, and if he wants to, the wood can sink and the metal can rise. Each miracle, we've been kind of doing each one on its own, but there are people that do comparative studies, like what did each new miracle show that the other one didn't show? You brought somebody back alive, you healed the leprosy, they all show the different powers of Hashem, different things that Hashem could do. Over here is the idea that sometimes people can fill in a role where they never saw themselves doing it. You know, that people that thought they would sink and they float, and where other people that float, they sink. Some people learned that this was an axe handle, and he like threw the handle in, and the handle went down into the water and got the axe, the blade, right? Right. This was a good shot. Bingo, and then you just pull it out. And so it's like, either way, it was a miracle, but, right, with the text, right. That's the.
You know, it's not impossible to imagine that the water was shallow and that just a weight would startle the waters and bring up,
I don't know. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been so upset. Now, if it was shallow, he could have just reached down for it.
That
would be that this was something. Now, they were so startled and so shocked that this happened that they just like stood around, like just, you know, watching, like everybody was going. So the Yomar Ha'i says, pick it up. So now he says, Yomar Ha'i, go pick it up. They usually picked it up, and he took it. So that's the. That's the next miracle, and then we continue on. Now, it's interesting, even though the general of Aram had been healed, and they saw the power of the Jewish people, that didn't prevent them from fighting against them. This is something we saw in Egypt, that even though Egypt had the 10 plagues, that didn't, Paro was still going to fight against us, but even though the sea split, the nations of the world can be very stubborn. In other words, their hatred for the Jewish people isn't stopped, even if they're not successful. Even if their plans are ruined, they go forward. And that's something to this day that still happens. They're not even if they see miraculous things happen, it doesn't seem to stop them. They still continue on with their plans. So, verse 8, Melech Aram Ha'il Nilchem B'Yisrael. And the king of Aram was fighting with the Jewish people. And he spoke with his advisors. He got his team, his national security team, together. They had a plan like this. They wanted to do a sneak attack. They wanted to do he's going to go to a certain place. This is an interesting expression, Plomi Almoni, such and such a place. We have that one or two places in Tanakh, like it means in a secret place. They don't even want to say where it was. They did a good job of keeping it secret where exactly they were going to hide. And then they would be there and they would set up a trap. Some people learned that this was like a chariot trap, where there's certain places on the road, chariots are pretty heavy, and they would dig underneath and the chariots would fall through the. Other people learned it was more like a terrorist band that would be waiting around the corner for they knew the whereabouts of the king of Israel, and when he passed by they would attack. It could be they knew that a full-fledged attack war they couldn't win, but maybe if they did something sneaky then they could Now, part of this was the lesson of the earlier battle where they hadn't won the battle, but the archer had shot the arrow up and they had gotten the king. So they learned that if you assassinate the leader, then that would solve the problem. They would win the war. That's what they had done with Achav. So that's what they did. Verse 10, good. V'yishlach melech Yisrael l'malchem asher omer lo ish Elokim. And, I skipped 9, I'm sorry. V'yishlach ish Elokim ha-melech Yisrael. Now, the man of God, he was a seer, and he saw things. This lesson that even though he was a seer, he couldn't see what was happening with Gehazi, it's just also a lesson to us that there are people that see all kinds of things, but sometimes they miss something in their own house. In other words, in the ideal world, it's like if you see, can't you see everything? No, sometimes you see certain things, and other things, we all have our blind spots. That's really what it amounts to. And so, Yisrael didn't see his own son with Esav, right. Here he sees that the enemies of the Jewish people are planning a trap to kill the king of Israel, but he hadn't known, you know, what was going on, that his own... Now, he found out after it happened that Gehazi took the money, but again, there's sometimes we have those things that we don't... It doesn't mean that people don't see. The Talmud asked a question that when... Rav Yochanan ben Zaka, I think it was, when he escaped during the destruction of the Second Temple, and the emperor told him, I'll give you a request. They asked why he didn't request that Jerusalem be spared. So one view is that Hashem hid that from him. Didn't put it in his mind to ask for that. There's another view that he felt if he asked for too much, he wouldn't get anything.
Yeah.
But there's one view that he just... they asked this question why, like, so there were, when the Germans invaded Europe, there were people who said, should we run to the Russians, or who are the socialists, the communists, who hate the Jews, they hate religion, or should we go to the Germans? And there were wise people who had a blind spot. They could not believe that the Germans in the middle of a civilized Europe would do anything, would be that bad. And the German Jews themselves, who lived amongst the Nazis, refused to believe that it was that bad, and they stayed. And then most of them were killed. It's very easy for us to say, oh, you know, those sages weren't so wise, or those people. It's, you know, in hindsight. But the only point I want to make is that sometimes we're blind to certain things, even wise people, and sometimes that's part of Hashem's plan. That for whatever reason those wise people didn't see what the Germans were intending, or that things would be so bad. They, you know, there have been other times when. So over here, Elisha saw what the what they were intending to do. He sends. Now keep in mind, this was the king of Israel who was mediocre. This was a king who was a descendant of the son of Jezebel. This was who, in some ways, was like his mother, and in some ways was like his father. And his father had, if he would, Achav was back and forth. So Yishak Melech Yisrael Amalek. I'm sorry, keep on saying verse 9. Yishak Yisrael Kim Amalek. So the man of God sends to the king of Israel, and we're saying, he Shama Avraham Malcham Azeh. He said, you better not travel to that such and such a place. He Shama Aram Nechitin. The Aram is setting up a secret trap in that place. Now, the king of Israel, he's also consistent in not wanting to believe the prophet. So he doesn't just say, oh, okay, thank you. He has to check it out for himself. Verse 10. He was careful over there. He checked it out, and he saw that it was true, and he was careful over there. Lo Achaz Lo Shtayim, and this happened more than once, meaning that there were several times that Aram tried to make a secret trap to capture us, and at least two times the king escaped because of Elisha. Now, the king of Aram was frustrated. He had no explanation for this. So he was convinced that he had somebody who was giving away state secrets. But Yasser Lev Melech Aram Al-Zavarza, and the king of Aram was very disturbed about it. Vikrel Avadav, he called all of his ministers. But Yomar Alem, he said to them, Hello, Taginuli, in modern Hebrew they say, Tagiduli, tell me. Right? Tagiduli, tell me. The word tagid is from the same word as Haggadah. Like, tell me the story. I want to hear the story. Tell me the story. Me, Mishalanu, who's giving away our secrets? Which one of you guys? Sometimes people believe that they can look at people and look them in the eye and see if they're telling the truth, to see how they react. You know, if you say something to them very quickly and surprise them, and you'll see if they react in a way that would give away, you know, the... So apparently he thought if he would say to them, are you the one who's spying for the king of Israel, that somehow they would say, you know, there would be something about their behavior that would give them away. It's somewhat like the lie detector test, that when somebody's lying, you could see it. So you can. There are ways to spot. Only somebody that's very... it's not easy to be able to withstand, you know, the... So, verse 12, Yomar Achamavadav Lo Adeni Amelach. So one of his servants says, no, it's none of us. None of us are giving away your secrets. Ki Elisha Hanavi Asher B'Yisrael. Yagi Lemel Yisrael. He said, it's interesting, I don't even know how he knew, but he said, the king of Israel has a secret weapon. He has a prophet, and the prophet tells him, he says, Sheh Tidabe V'Chei L'Mishpah, he knows what's going on in your bedroom. It's the, you can't hide secrets from the prophet, he is a prophet, the prophets know everything. And this was well known, and so that's what he told him. Verse 13. Now, instead of saying, wow, I better watch my behavior, what does he do? He says, all right, let's go get him. Verse 13, go, let me see this man. They said, all right, where is this prophet? He's preventing us from surprising the king of Israel. He's giving away our plans. Let's go get him. So they said, where is he? Lamor, he named Dothan. He's in Dothan, Alabama. But Dothan, he's over there in Dothan. The funny thing is, in Chumash, Dothan is mentioned when Yosef was looking for his brothers. It mentions that that was the place that he was in Dothan. I don't know what the significance of that was. But it is mentioned in other places in Tanakh. Other than that, I don't know much about that that city. But apparently Elisha was visiting there. Verse 14, Yishak Shama Susim Erecha V'chayel Kavit. So he sends out, he brings out the troops. He brings out the horses and the chariots and the armies. And the yellow lila, and they come at night. This way, nobody know they're coming. The akifu al ear, they surround the city. 15. The yashdim misharis ishelokim. He had very good intelligence, but I suppose the prophet was a teacher, and he taught large groups of people, and so people knew where he was. He was a famous person, and they knew that, you know, this is where he was presenting. Now the king, this time we don't know who the king's after Gehazi, we don't know their name anymore, who his Meshoras is. His in other words, Gehazi was well known, great person, he had his own name. Now we just know that it's the assistant. Maybe at this point, so the assistant to the prophet gets up. It could be because over here he lacks a certain amount of faith, we don't want to mention him by name, you know, we want to spare him, we don't want him to go down in history as the guy that, you know, the student that didn't believe in the master. And there's a very beautiful lesson over here. So the student wakes up early in the morning, you know, you wake up early, get ready for davening, and he looks outside and he looks out the city, and as far as the eye can see, there's chariots and horses and armies. And Vayomanawe love, aha. Now this is a real aha. Before it was with the blade of the air. He says, aha, Hashem Echana. Now what? What are we gonna do? Apparently they knew that they were under attack from this kind of army. Could only a siege on the city could only mean one thing, that they were going to go to war against them, attack them. So the prophet tells him very interesting words. The Yomer Al Tiri, don't be afraid. Ki Rabbi Masher Hayitanu Masher Osim. He said, we got more people on our side than them. We outnumber them. He was impressed with the numbers. Look at all those Gentiles. Look at all those armies, those horses. And the prophet said very famous words. He says, we're the stronger side over here. Verse 17. Another miracle. Yomer Hashem. Poka Noraseinu. Now, he doesn't say create the army. He just says open his eyes. Let him see the reality of things. So he opened the year of Yitzhak Hashem, Mr. Enei Anar. And Hashem opens the eyes of the lad, Bayar, and he sees Enei Ahar, Moli Susim, the Rech of Eish Savivo Elisha. He shows him that Elisha has a spiritual army, a fire, much greater than the nations that surround them. And there is this. We tend to live only in this world. We're very practical. This is the world we see. But we believe that opposite this world is the spiritual world. And it's a world we don't see. We have a lot of this in the Parsha, where Yaakov is leaving the land of Israel, and he dreams the ladder. He sees the angels going up. These were the angels that accompany him. So we believe that we have angels that accompany us when we go. When Shabbos comes in, we greet the Shabbos angels that come. Shalom Aleichem, right? And the weekday angels. And we believe that there are spiritual forces that go with us when we go play. We don't necessarily see them. Sometimes we feel them. Sometimes there can be a negative spiritual force. When a person does a sin, it is a negative spiritual force that clings to the person that goes with them. There are certain times where we feel spiritual forces. There's certain times. There's certain people that you go to where you get vibes. You can feel an evil, and you can feel a holiness. There are certain places you go to where there's something. Certain moments where you know it's a. But there is this other world that's out there. There's this other spiritual world where that exists beyond the reality of what we see here and now. You might say, well, our class is very small, and we could open our eyes up in the heaven. Who knows, you know, what's up there? You know, there might be a cheerleading squad up there, you know, which, you know, might be. But we have to be always open to there being another dimension to life than what we see. That's really the message over here. And so he looks to him, it looked like we were outnumbered. And he said, no, they're outnumbered. You don't see the real picture. The real picture is, throughout history it's been that way, that the wars aren't won by numbers. Necessarily. It's the, and there are different forces on each side. And sometimes you have to open your eyes to see what's really there. And so Elisha was able to open his eyes and to see what was on our side, so to speak. Sometimes we say a person is sent by another person, and the person says, "Well, I'll go with you. My spirit will go with you." Right? And with sometimes we when we do things, it's sometimes not on our merit, but it's because of those that came before us that they protect us. They're with us. And sometimes people that are very close with someone, they actually sense it. And so we tend to say, yeah, they're just, you know, they just miss their spouse a lot, or they just, but it's not fair. Sometimes it's true. You know, it's no question that people hallucinate a little bit. Some people do, but there are other times people feel that they sense the presence of a spouse, a loved one, they're in tune to it. Again, there's another dimension. We don't know. There are spiritual people, there are people that know, or the guests, but we're open to the idea that there's another dimension. Whether or not all of us are sensitive to it, and to what extent, that I don't know. But there is this other spiritual dimension, the world of souls, the world of angels, and so things, we know this, things aren't always what they seem. And that's the. So he says, you open your eyes and you see the heavenly angels, it's a whole different story. Yeah, there are Kabbalistic things. There are other things that describe, you know, different possibilities. But for the most part, we never know for sure. But I think it's very important to be open to that idea that there are different dimensions, that there is another, you know, that different things exist that we may not be aware of. And so that changes the ballgame. So sometimes, like, we go out and we imagine that we're all by ourselves, and we're not alone. We have a lot of things that go with us. We have our forebears that go with us. We have our, the angels of Hashem that are with us. We have our good deeds that go with us. And so there are things that we accomplish. It's because it's not just us. We're surrounded by the fiery angels, so to speak. Verse 18. Now, they don't actually wage war, but this was just a miracle to show him that he did. There's no reason to fear. Verse 8, now, Elisha goes down and he davens to Hashem and he says, Hachnes Agoyazah. These people should be blind. They should be stricken with a blindness. They castitate, and this is what happened. The army and these troops that surrounding the city, they couldn't see. They say they have in the Middle East. That's why theirs wear those funny towels over their faces. They have these sandstorms where nobody can see. You know, they literally can't see because the dust. What do they call it? A Chamsun, right. And it's like, there was nobody could see. Ve'yomar aleihem Elisha. So they couldn't see. And Elisha says to them, now they're trying to capture Elisha. And he goes and he starts talking to them. And he says, Lozu Adera. He says, you guys are in the wrong place. You're lost. Lozu Adera, you got the wrong city. I'll show you where to go. And he leads them, apparently this is like the group of the generals or the scouting party, and he leads them, I said, I'll take you to where you want to go, to Vaksha Vieko Sam Shomronim. And he takes them to the city close by called Shomron, which is the capital city of the ten tribes, where all the army was. Verse 20, now they get to Shomron, and Elisha says, Hashem, open their eyes. Ruv Yifashem, and all of a sudden they open their eyes, and all of a sudden they are surrounded in the middle of the Jewish camp. Yevinei b'sof Shomron. And so now this band of people of this SWAT team that was out to capture Elisha now is stuck in the middle of the capital of the ten tribes. Now the king of the ten tribes got a present. Now he has this. These people, Ve'yomar Melech Yisrael, and the king of Israel says to Elisha, to Rososam, when he sees him, he says, Aka, Aka, Avi. He says, Father, should I get him? Should we kill him? Now it's interesting. His father Achav was faulted for letting the idolaters go. So he had almost learned his lesson, like in saying, all right, you know, we got him. Maybe we should kill him. Verse 22, Ve'yomar Lo Tzaka. He says it's not right to kill them. Asher shavita b'char b'char b'kashtecha. You know, when you capture somebody with your sword and your bow and they're fighting you in war, so in war, maybe that's fair. Atamakasim lahem umayim. But now you're giving them miraculously. They were like captured. So, you know what? Sim lechem umayim. Give them bread and water. V'yochol v'yishtu v'yochol. Let them go back. Maybe this will be effective. And we're going to see, sometimes people forget that the purpose of a battle is not just to win a battle, but is to eventually be able to make peace with the other side, or to accomplish what you need to accomplish. And so here was the message that he should do this to get the Aram to stop these plots. And not only did he give him bread and water, he made him a big party. He made them a big party, and they went home to their masters. And somehow, after this experience, they never did it again. Either they were, as they said, the Jews are nice guys, we shouldn't go and do it, or you can't fight against them. Look what kind of powers they have. And so that was the... at least they didn't try it with these small bands. We're going to see that they later on would try other things, but they didn't try this guerrilla warfare anymore because they realized they wouldn't be successful. We will stop here on 24. And again, a lot of interesting lessons or miracles that happen. Each one has its own insight or lesson that's meant to be taught.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the Donate link. Thank you very much.